Strategy for Quebec, so we'll improve on how we manage stroke. And the nice thing is that rehab is front center in all of the early minutes of managing a stroke, and so I think that's really nice. So that is one area where we're really, really changing, okay, so that beginning part. The other thing is I gave you a little assignment that we haven't talked about yet, and that was on that first one about cost and where we put our monies for stroke. Because he presented some data. So in the second half of today's lecture, I'd like to revisit that and talk, because our lecture today is in two parts. This is assessment, and I'm going to try not to lecture a lot, because I think you're all probably taught about assessment at your union, when really what you want to do, I remember that for people who aren't going to be here, I should have okay, how's that? Is it too loud? No. All right, I got it on. That's pretty good. Okay. So the first part, I don't want to lecture to you on outcomes because I think you already know a lot, but I do want to talk about the philosophy of how you're going to do assessment forever in the future as you assess this clientele. And then in the second half, so if you think back to Dr. Rochette, she talked to you about a group of patients that we kind of ignore, and that's the mild stroke. And today I want to talk to you about the other group that we ignore. We spend millions and millions and millions of dollars in the last 5 to 8 years looking at research on this group and effectiveness of intervention, and yet in clinical practice we ignore them. And do you know which group that is? What the word chronic stroke, and really that word should be thrown out. We call it chronic stroke, and if you look, I think I just have a publication out in the, I can't remember where it's published, but there's a new one out where we talk about taking the chronic out of stroke, because really what it becomes is like anything else, it's a condition that you live with usually over a long period of time. And so people often think of chronic as someone you put on the back shelf. So today we're going to look at the evidence. Sorry, I'm not used to this, so I'm not looking at you. We're going to look at the evidence to see, is it true that these people just flatline? And I have some fun information for you about that. I want to also today cover what we haven't talked about yet. And I was thinking, how can we do it easily in this lecture? So does everybody have a good old-fashioned paper and pencil or a little note piece on their computer? That's fine, too. Just put yourself into, and we did a little bit of it last week when we talked about gait and balance, put yourself into the brain of a clinician, and it doesn't matter which discipline, occupational therapy, physical therapy. You are now working on a stroke unit. That's your first job when you graduate. And because you've taken this course, likely you're going to be very competitive when you go for interviews and say you'd like to work on a stroke unit. What, write down very quickly some of the constructs, so what does that mean? Just some of the domains that you think would be important for you, whatever your discipline is, to assess when you walk into the room that first day and then the next day, so like that 48-hour window. Scribble quickly. You don't have to, you know, torture your brain. Scribble a few thoughts about what you'd really want to make sure, regardless if it's a left hemisphere lesion or right, just some things you want to make sure that you pick up on. So I'll give you a couple of minutes. Scribble, scribble. So now we're going to do what's called a quick round robin. Everybody's going to shout something out. We're going to go up and down. We'll start maybe at the back. And anything. And if somebody's already said it and those are your three things, don't be uncomfortable. Just say pass, okay? So it's not to put you on the spot and to go, oh, my God, I can't think of anything else. She used mine. So just say pass. But let's see the constructs that we would first in our brain quickly think that we would want to measure. 48 hours, acute care patient. Don't know a lot about them, except we would have, you know, a little piece of information, left or right hemisphere lesion, and now we're in there. Go ahead, pick something. Dysphagia with a G? Okay, next. Orientation. You can add one or pass. Speech.
Cognition.
Okay. Screening for movements that are affected. Insight, judgment.
Social support.
Pain. In bed or not, but I didn't hear your first word. Sorry, that was a swallow. Bed mobility. And sorry, I missed you behind.
Hand dominance.
Crude balance. Sitting. Try standing. Just quickly to see where you could go with that. Okay. Oh, she's not looking up, so I'll come back here. ADLs? Now, anybody just yell out anything, so I don't put you on the spot and you start sweating. Some people are more comfortable just speaking and others are not. Perception? Who else had ideas? If they drive? Sensation. Risk of falls. Spasticity.
Hygiene.
Neglect. Wow. General comprehension. Yeah. Vision.
Strength and range of motion.
Apraxia. Yeah. Okay, push the bell, call for help. Key things in the first 24 to 48 hours. You've had experience. Anything? Transfers? So if you did the balance. Okay, so one of the comments when we do groups with clinicians is they often tell us when they work in acute care that they spend so much time assessing that they never feel like they ever actually treat anything. Have you heard that one? Yeah, a lot. And I'm sure you feel the same way. So the dilemma becomes you don't want to miss any of the things that you said, but how do you do it so that you don't only, you know, ask them questions? And someone made a comment here last week that patients often get fed up because it's the same questions over and over and over. Okay, so all of the constructs that you talked about were excellent, the sensation range of motion. What are a lot of those? And I like the way you mix, so you did a really good job. What are the, if we look at the World Health Organization classifications, what are things like sensation, range of motion, strength? They're the physical, so they're more at the impairment level, the body structures and functions, what we call now. And I want to show you some data because I hope you'll be the generation who doesn't replicate what we found. And, you know, I've looked at about 1,200 OTs and PTs and another 450 SLPs. And we did that in 2005, 2006, and we looked at what they use in terms of assessment. So based on everything you said, we're going to move forward now and take a look. Just a few things that I didn't want to cover today, but I do want to make sure you understand quickly, because somebody just said the word screening. Everybody here clear on what's screening versus assessment? If not, don't be shy. Don't check around to make sure everyone else isn't clear. Just stick up your hand and we'll do it quickly. Screening versus assessment. You're good? Everybody good? Okay. So
The other thing is, we're not going to talk so much today about specific tools because those are in 2010 best practice guidelines. We put a lot of effort in this round to put in the names of specific tools, and some of you have already gone to the best practices and seen those. So that we're not going to do. And you know that on the Assess site, we try to get a lot of tools in there, and we'll have about another 12 or so specific to executive function coming up in the next few weeks. So what I want to do is, based on what we've learned about what clinicians do, and I'll show you some of it, I really think that we're messing ourselves up. One of the things we do is we often assess or screen early on. What do you think we don't do well after we do all of that screening and assessment to see what the patient looks like? Yeah, we're really bad at reassessing. Terrible at reassessing. So if we don't reassess, what do we mess up on? Yeah, we're not noting progress, and we're not changing our practices accordingly. So that's a problem. And so the other thing is, I just want to talk today about the importance of using tools that are responsive. As we all know, we saw that they just cut all the nursing from the ER over at the MUHC. Have you all been reading the papers about all the cuts? The last thing we want to do is look like we don't measure our outcomes, because we need to show evidence that what we do works and is actually cost effective for the government. And unfortunately, when we do not, and I'll show you the evidence that we knew we weren't measuring, reassessing, then we have absolutely no evidence. We can jump up and down, but we don't have anything to show. And the other thing is, I want to talk very briefly today, because I think as you become frontline experts in what you do, so the whole philosophy behind a stroke unit is that each person on that team has expertise. So the hierarchy on those teams are gone. It's not that one person is the boss of the other. Those units don't work well. The philosophy is that each of you have been trained in a discipline with specific expertise. You come to the table with that expertise that you do better than others on the team. That's the whole reason that patients survive on stroke units, because it's so complex treating this condition that you each have to be experts. So I want you to take a little time to talk about, how do you pick diagnostic tools as an OT or as a PT so that you aim at what you want in terms of information and you don't mess up. So I don't want to spend a lot of time on that, because I know you're keen to do this, to do real stuff about patients. And the other thing I wanted to mention, I'm taking a little bit of an aside, is I want you during the course of the next weeks to tell me, because the semester, this one goes so quickly, what is it that you want to see? And I will go hunting and searching for those patients. So if you want to see a patient actually with unilateral spatial neglect because you haven't, or if you want to see an actual video fluoroscopy, or if you want to see gait training, well, that'll be for sure because we're going to go to the Jewish rehab, let me know and I'll try to make sure. Like, one of the things is FES is something. Do you all know how to do FES? Have you taken the... Okay. But for PT, you're comfortable with upper limb stroke FES intervention, but are the OTs? Okay, so I think we should create a special module, if you're willing and want to, for that, because it's got high-level evidence of effectiveness for upper limb. So always tell me those things, and I'll adjust and try to get what you feel you're missing, okay? Because I don't want you to leave this course saying, oh, all we did was theory, and I still have no good sense of what someone with a stroke looks like. All right, so these are all the things that we work on. And it's complicated, and there's lots. And there's a lot of evidence in every area. So it makes it fun for us because we have strong evidence now, which is a lot more fun than it used to be, treating someone when you know you're doing evidence-based practice. But it's also confusing. Like, how to treat executive function will be an entire lecture that you will have, because it's brand new, and a lot of people have never treated executive dysfunction. So you're going to hear a lot about that. Similarly, dysphagia. Dysphagia was not well done. The screening tools were not created And so we had a lot of aspiration pneumonia, and so we're going to have someone come in from the VIC, and she will show you video fluoroscopies and what they look like when somebody is aspirating, et cetera, et cetera. You probably have had quite a bit of that, though, given that we have expertise here at the school. Yes? Yes. So, again, only tell her or tell me, and I'll tell her what you want to hear about so that it's not redundant for you. And again, we now know a lot more about patient fatigue. We heard about even in mild stroke, Annie Hachette was saying fatigue is a major issue. We know in traumatic brain injury, again, it's a major issue. So how do you manage to do all your intensive therapy when you're dealing with motivation, depression issues? And again, we know post-stroke depression affects a very high number of people. So how do you measure it all? How do you do it right? Last week I was in Thunder Bay, and Jill Cameron, who does a lot of work, if you Google her, she's an OT at U of T, and she does a lot of work in caregivers and how to empower the families so that people get home. And so she was talking about her randomized trial and simple things, you know, that we forget as clinicians. One person said social support when we talked about what constructs to measure. But often we say, and I know you've all learned, right? Have you all learned that family is very important when you treat a patient? And we talk the talk and we walk the walk, but when it really comes down to it, we seldom have families highly incorporated into our therapies. And so we know from Jill's work that she was presenting that patients have a much greater likelihood of getting home if the family is confident and knows what they're doing. And again, just we don't do it very well. This is, again, Ian Graham. Ian, who created this knowledge to action, knowledge translation. And so the whole question is, what do we do with patients who've had strokes? How do we incorporate their families? How do we maximize treatment so that they survive and that they survive with a decent quality of life? So if you think about all the words you said to me, you said so many words. How do we make sure they have ADLs? How do we make sure they're dressing and washing, but they're not falling? Because you told me we're worried about falls. You told me about sitting balance and standing balance. You told me about range of motion and strength training we need to do. We have to worry about dysphagia. They have to eat mushy, soft foods, which they hate. They're not going to like it. They might have issues of incontinence we haven't assessed for yet. They might be diabetic and have other issues of just comorbidities. They might be arthritic, and so everything hurts, and now they're lying in bed too long. So how do we put that all together to do quality stroke care? And that's, you know, what we're talking about today. So these were the people. I don't want to spend a lot of time today. This was our study, and you could see that we studied a huge number of OTs and PTs. And some of them had a lot of experience. So it's not that I interviewed people with little bits of experience. So remember that when you see what you see. And we asked them things like this. So here's the patient that we sent to each one of those 1,200 people. If you told me that you worked in acute care and you saw more than two patients with stroke a month, this was the vignette that you got. You got the acute care vignette. And take a moment. I'm going to stop talking and just read through what this patient looks like. And then we're going to talk about what they told us they do and what maybe you're thinking we should do differently. Everyone had time to read? Okay, so now, of all the things that were shouted out earlier about assessment, take a look. The way you handle a case, the way we have now decided that in stroke we, and you could probably use it anywhere, is that you should look at four different pieces, and that's what we've been talking about a little bit in the course. So as soon as you read the chart, your brain starts to go to problems, concerns, right? You're reading the chart, and that's your natural. You're picking up cues. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, based on those concerns slash cues, what's the next logical thing? You screen and you, if you find trouble with the screen, you go further and you do a full? Yeah, okay, so you picked up the chart, you see that the person has a right hemisphere lesion, your brain starts going right hemisphere. Okay, what, you know, anatomy, neuroanatomy, what do I remember about right hemisphere? Okay, and then you start reading the chart. It's going to be a real skimpy chart. They just got there. What am I seeing from the neuro report from ER? And that's where your brain starts going. So obviously, if the chart says, patient came in, had some tingling in the left upper and lower limbs, seems to have resolved, now able to speak clearly, had a chat, is walking around, went to the bathroom, seems to be, you're not going to start what? What part of that screening would you probably not do? Now you're nervous. I'm nervous too, because there's nothing I want to take out in case I miss something. Is there anything we want to miss? But we don't have time. The reality is we don't have time. So that's the... Like, remember we talked about maybe this person doesn't need an assessment for USN. But what did we also worry about? We haven't done the lecture yet, but if they're going home driving because they left doing so well, have we taken a quick look at extra far person, you know, the beyond the personal space we would typically measure? So a quick overall screen is probably a great idea. Okay. So take a look at this one, and you're reading this chart, and now just tell me some of the things that your brain is saying, this might be a problem, I should do something about screening or assessment. So what things in there? Dysphagia might be a concern. We have some, what else? Some issue of incontinence, and what kinds of incontinence does this person maybe have? Good. Why? Okay. So does everyone know that? You're not... It's okay if you don't, because not all of us... Yeah. So often people who have stress incontinence, which is a different type of incontinence, which will be managed differently, will sneeze and have a little dribble. So that's a clue that we had put in there. What else? Balance and mobility might be an issue. You want to get a better handle on what's going on there. There's something going on with, we think, maybe speech. Hmm? Swallowing. Yeah. Yeah. Somebody had mentioned dysphagia, so you would think that those would, yeah. And what else? What's going on with this? Right, so exactly. You both said really good things, okay? That's why a team is wonderful. So one member of the team says, oh, the person probably has shoulder pain. We better evaluate for shoulder pain. And the other person says, depressed about, you know, look what happened to my arm, okay? And that's why teams are beautiful, because both things have to be ruled out. Is it that the person has some pain? That would be very early for the pain. Because hopefully there hasn't been a lot of pulling and tugging yet on that limb, but it could be, oh my God, what's happened to me? I can't understand, and I'm not speaking enough to really get the whole thing out because I'm so overwhelmed. So it could be one or both, and that's what's the beauty. Anything else? I think we're good to go. So we asked people about the problems, and then we know that about 55% of people will have problems with dysphagia. And undetected, we know, has really horrible outcomes. So if you're going to work somewhere outside of Montreal or a major city And you are the person out there. Always make sure you know about dysphagia because it is so often undetected, especially in rural Canada. And we keep trying to push it, but rest of Canada really pushes hard that only SLPs are allowed to assess for dysphagia. I disagree with the concept, and here in Quebec, we've had all kinds of back and forth, but the bottom line is the team has to make sure that someone's there 7 days a week who can pick up on dysphagia when the patient comes in. So what we say is that they have to be screened in the first 24 hours, and it has to be a trained clinician. And again, you see, when you see words like that, it seems simplistic. But this is like a two-day conference fighting in Toronto to not get the word by a trained speech-language pathologist. Okay, so that's recognizing that a nurse or an occupational therapist who's trained is better than an SLP who comes in next Tuesday. And the other thing is, of course, if you come in on a Friday, and we all like to work only Monday through Friday, we like the job that way, the patient then what? Has to wait till Monday, not fed, until someone assesses them. So again, when we put in the 2008 best practice guidelines, I go home and I go to sleep and I love my food and I eat the next morning, but I've now made a huge amount of patients come in, had a stroke, and now they're not eating for the next 3 days because the healthcare system's not in place. So you have to think what you're doing when you put these things into place. Who should assess? It bugs you. Not a good story. Not a good story. Okay. So you saw the cue there. How many people, when you read that cue of the patient, picked up on the fact that we should be concerned about dysphagia? Yeah. Okay. And McGill has pushed very hard on training related to dysphagia. And that's what we found. Now, was that cue, in your opinion, clear that we put in the vignette? Was it tricky enough? You know, sometimes you write an exam and you say, oh, but that was a trick question. Was that tricky? Was it pretty clear? Yeah. So having done hundreds and hundreds of these, I can tell you that the speech language pathologist who did not say the word swallowing, like we gave, they didn't have to say the word dysphagia. We gave it to them if they said things like swallowing, anything that, you know, concern about eating and choking. The ones who received that vignette, because we had different vignettes, and didn't have a specific speech impairment written out as a cue, told us, you've sent me the wrong vignette. You sent me the wrong patient. There's nothing that I can do with this patient. So in other words, we still have a group of people, like you're saying, who were not paying attention and were not aware. That hopefully has been eliminated. We hope that we won't see that anymore. But even so, what I really liked is even though OT and PT weren't at 100% at that point, you can see that both disciplines took responsibility for problem identification. And when I sat and looked at the data for the last years, all this data, tons of it, one of the things that I've learned is that when you work as a team together, if 60% of one discipline picks up something and 60% of the other discipline, you're still covering. You've covered. It's like an insurance policy for your patient. And when people write articles, if you type in stroke units, why do they work? There's a whole slew of papers on the philosophy about why it works. That, to me, is why it works. It's called, in my brain, a safety net. You safety net for each other so that if you're good colleagues and you trust each other, in the end, you cover all bases. And I'm sure that's why, and here's, you can see, that in 2006, we were still, with a very clear cue, having half of Canadian OTs and PTs not identifying a very important sequelae post-stroke. So
Remember this one? This was in the vignette, spouse worried about peace. Oh, maybe this was in a different one. When it will take place and how they will manage at home. This was, I cut the vignette short because I didn't want you to have to read so much. And here's the, what do you think? Do you think a lot of people said one of the problem cues and picked it up as a family or caregiver concern or any words like that? Here's what we got. High, low, pathetic? Pathetic, okay. So one of the things I really learned from doing this survey is that even though we talk a lot about families and concern about, well, you know, will they be able to manage at home, we actually put very little attention in those days, and we published that. And one of the things we're hoping is that now, if we look at this again, and we've just conducted a study on another few hundred clinicians, that we're going to see a very different picture as we analyze the data. And I hope that you certainly would be a very different. And then, you know, I do a lot of work in driving, so of course I had to throw in this little cue. Did everyone see the cue on driving? And so here's what we got. In the acute care, this was the cue we used. In rehab, this was the cue we used. And here's what we got. And the patients substantiate this. And we're going to have a whole hour and a half on the driving and how to screen and assess properly. But our patients tell us this. And like I told you the story, they go home and practice on their own. They give it a try. And so when we say, oh, maybe our study was wrong. Now, do you know what ADL was for OT? If I put in percentages there of those who picked up on the cue for washing, dressing, and whatever? 100%. So our data is valid. We were able to cross-validate with many, many things we know we do all the time. So it's not like people were bored and didn't answer properly or whatever. They really left out chunks. And that was the community. And this really upset me and scared me because we asked the same thing. We had a community vignette for those working in the community where the patient was home and he kept saying in the vignette, and I'm really interested in going back to driving now that I'm home. Like, how clearer can you make it? Ta-da! So we have to step up the pace. And then the other thing is we asked the clinicians not only about assessments but timing. And here's what we found, quickly, again, because I don't want to use too much time. When we asked people what assessments they would use for the patients that we showed them in the vignettes, we got over 500 assessments. So my bottom line, you know, you always want a bottom line for things. My bottom line was, let's not create any new assessments. We have enough rehab assessments. We probably don't need any more. We also had therapists who said, I watched them. I don't know what you mean by assessment. Like, I watched them. So that was the huge variety I got. And then I had other ones where we had to use three extra pages. You know, we're typing and we've used up all the fields because they did so much assessment that I was thinking this poor patient's never going to be treated. Kind of every word you use, they were using in their actual practice. So I think we have to go somewhere in between. And this was what people used. One of the interesting things, I'm going to show you something you told me last week about the past. I'm going to show you some information. What we asked them in terms of what would be the key things they would assess with that patient, those are them. Those were the key words mentioned out of the 500 assessments. So take a look and then tell me, summarize it in one sentence in your brain. So this was physio, working in acute care. That's why it's 201. So the question is, for that patient, after we asked them what potential problems, we said, what kind of assessment would you do and when would you do it? So now I'm showing you the data on what kind of assessment they would do on the patient, and these are the top ones that came up. So there were 500 different ones, but the most prevalent one, so out of 201 clinicians working as PTs in acute care, 120 of them told us I would use the Berg. That's what I typically use with that type of patient. And then they said tone and strength. So what do you see about all of those seven domains or constructs?
all physical. Okay, so a lot of attention, and it makes sense in the acute care, a lot of physical. And then this was the only scale where I was talking to you about responsiveness and making sure you pick up on change. The Berg was the only scale that people actually used over again. So there's something about the Berg that people like. They find it informative, and they use it over again, which is amazing because all the other tools nobody used again. They didn't. And I thought this one was fun. I threw this one in because last week you told me about the patient that we were talking about, the gait balance patient. You remember that last week? And look at PASS. Because a lot of you recommended that the PASS would be a really good tool to use. So in 2006, no one had heard about the PASS yet. And I think that might be one of the reasons that the Berg was so popular. And now I was really pleased last week you were saying, well, there are other things that potentially we could use. And so those were some of the ones. In OT, this is what people were using in acute care. And again, take a look at the domains. Is that what you would have thought in a patient that, like we saw? Hearing assessment? So those were the constructs. Those were the words that people said. So like if they gave us the name of a specific tool, we put it down if it was in the top bunch. And you could see that basically what they did was ADL, cognition, by the mini-mental. Mini-mental a good choice? No, you all told me last week that there's a much better choice. What is it? The MoCA would be a much better choice for you to plan treatment with. And also executive function was never mentioned in the top 20. And we had one clinician in Canada say they would measure executive function in 2006. So I thought it was fun. I didn't want to spend a lot of time on research with you today, but what I thought was fun is that last week I was so impressed because you were coming up with tools that were not used a few years ago. You're already at the beginning of term, you know, with a good idea of what you should do instead of what was done then. So I think it's really nice to see the change. Yeah. Okay, so your question is great. It's like, okay, in acute care, is it before going to a rehab? Would we expect that rehab would take care of that issue? So remember... That's right. It's not a priority. And that's why we did it. Things, and your question's terrific, right? Because, like, come on, acute care, give me a break as a clinician. Don't punish me that this patient just came in and I'm not assessing driving. You're being totally nuts. So that's why, if you notice, we put the cues in across the continuum of care, hoping that I could write the publication saying, and of course, by community, 99% of clinicians indicated that they would pick up the pace and worry about screening and assessment of driving. And you can see it was 32% by community. And so that is exactly right. We argue that certain things you would not focus on because you would, as I said to you, if we assessed everything, you'd never treat. Ridiculous. Yeah. So you're 100% right. And these were, you know, here's all of the different cognitive and memory assessments. And I always say to people, I bet you can't read them. They're so small. And I do it on purpose to say, this is what happens when we pick so many different tools. We can't read it. We can't talk to each other. We have no meaning to the scales. And so one of the things I'm really happy about is that the MoCA is coming out as something popular, and people seem to like it. It has good psychometrics. It's doable. You can even get a mini mental. So if there are people who don't understand what the MoCA is and insist on a mini mental, you can kind of steal that mini mental out of it, a little sub And you can see here the other thing that's quite popular is the PECPA or CASE. And have you heard of PECPA or CASE? English or French versions is also very popular. And just this is depression and mood. A lot of people assessing. Very low. Very low. And one of the things we know now is that we've really neglected depression. And, you know, there's a lot more emphasis now on detecting depression. And there used to be a point where people would say, well, of course they're depressed. They just had a stroke. And that's a really silly, old-fashioned comment that shouldn't be there anymore. And then one of the comments that you made to me earlier is, yes, I bet we do a lot of initial assessment and not so much over time to show off our work. And is that what we found? Have all of you ever heard of the Head Start program? The Head Start program was a program of enrichment that was started. And the reason I'm telling you the story has nothing to do with stroke, but it does have to do with why and what we measure. So Head Start was a program that was started in the United States where they did enriched programming for very little ones, like 4 and 5 year olds. This was the time before all kids went to nursery. And the idea was that children from lower socioeconomic status or single-parent homes where there were very few books, toys, etc., would start life with a more enriched environment. And they did this rigorous randomized trial, very methodologically rigorous. They randomized kids to receive Head Start or not. They followed them at 5 and 6 years of age on some outcomes, and they found no difference between the two groups, at which point most of the Head Start funding was cut because there was no evidence. The researchers continued to follow these children into their 20s. And although I don't remember every detail of every outcome, they monitored things like jail time, delinquency, all the negative and positive things, employment, and found a significant, substantial, almost like 20% difference between those who had been in the Head Start program as little kids and those who had not, when they measured them at 20 years. And so I always think of that because that always left a lasting impression. If you measure the wrong thing as a clinician, it's disastrous. So often someone will say, like, well, you put so much work into Mrs. So-and-so, but my patient, I didn't do the whole family and involvement and show them how to transfer, and they both went home last Thursday after 8 days. Yeah, maybe their length of stays were identical. But if you don't measure things like return to acute care hospital, falls, caregiver burnout, you know, back pain and hospitalization of the caregiver, because we know that they have a high rate in the first year of disintegrating, then you'll never capture the effectiveness of your interventions. So that's just something that you have to think of, because I see a lot of what we measure is very short-term. Why do we do it? Because as researchers, we get tired. So we measure, you know, at 6 weeks post whatever intervention. But you have to really think of the impact of what you do much longer. And we've been horrible. You can see how little we do in terms of long-term. And we know what responsiveness is. And you all know ceiling and floor because you told me, but you were a little bit mishmash, some of you, last time, right? Having to remember. So quickly, the ceiling effect. I'll give you, tell me which is this. Is this a floor or a ceiling? I'm back walking in the community. I had a stroke, but I have to walk a lot on uneven ground. I'm a farmer. And you give me the Berg balance scale, and I score a top score. Ice ceiling, not a good scale because it's ceilinged. The opposite, I'm bedridden, not really mobile. You give me the Berg, and you said let's use the PASS, floor effect. Okay? Predictive measures, really what you want to do in acute care is you want to get in and you want to screen for the key issues. And you want to do it as quickly and accurately as possible. Everybody remember your principles of make sure you get the patients that you need to get and don't waste lots of energy and time we can't afford in the healthcare system treating those you shouldn't be treating? That's the principle behind accurate diagnostics. Everybody agree? In the perfect world, we'd have some extra money to treat those who don't need it, but really what we need to do is pick up on those who need it and treat them. And so really the best way to do that is through diagnostics. And I didn't know how much you remember of this, so again, I don't want to spend time today on it, but I want you to know if you're comfy with it. So I'll ask you one question, and then I'll know. If you all yell out the answer, then I'll know that you know it. In a perfect world, if we were doing a quick screen of depression, real quick, it's two questions. What would we want in a perfect world the sensitivity of that tool to be? Are we all yelling out one answer? What would we want it to be in a perfect world? 100%. Yes? It means that with two quick questions, I can check off in my checklist of admission that I did a depression screen. And I can be a best practice clinician. Okay? What would we want the specificity to be in a perfect world? We want to be 100%. Why? Because in a perfect world, 100%, 100% means we picked up every single person that's depressed with our real quick screen, two questions, and we didn't waste any resources because we had specificity, meaning if you weren't depressed, I didn't pick you up as depressed. So those who aren't, and those who are, and I picked everybody right, and I put everybody in the right pile, and I didn't mess up. Everybody got it? So just review when you're, again, this is not the time to do an in-depth on this, but just to tell you that, you know, if you are trying to pick up something that's really serious, like USN, which we're going to talk about, because we know people fall, they get up, they try to do things, they fall, or they drive and they crash. You want a highly sensitive tool, but you're never going to get that ideal world of 100 and 100%. Very rare. Very, very rare. And like I said, people who are told on Monday morning at the doctor's that they're diabetic, it's not 100%. It just means along the continuum, your sugars now went to over here, so we're going to call you diabetic, but if they were right there, we'd call you not diabetic. And so things are on a continuum, and we chop them off, and we make them into chunks. So everybody remember that as you're picking tools. All right, and we're not going to go through this. And we're not going to go through this, because we'll do it when we do driving. Goodbye. So that's why we created the Stroke Engine Assess site. It's not perfect. But we created it so that we could kind of get the Canadian clinicians to have an opportunity to look at what the tools are. This is our old site. It now looks very different. We now have domains where you can click and see all the tools under a domain, etc. And what we're hoping is for a few things. Number one, that we won't have 500 tools that people are using. That when they see a problem like the word, you know, person choking on water, that they'll all say words like I'm concerned and we'll need to assess for dysphagia, etc., etc. And now we know that websites are kind of getting old-fashioned, and so we've had one of you actually get a Canadian Stroke Network Summer Fellowship, and with that we've been able to create an upper limb app storyboard where we are hoping, we have it already, that you'll see a little vignette, if you like, of a patient that looks similar to one that's come into your clinic and you're not sure what to do. There's so much evidence on upper limb now and it's changing all the time. You'll be able to click on what assessments to use, what interventions to use, and do a decision tool based on what your patient's scores are on their assessments. So we've mapped out the whole thing. And we have an international group of about 30 people who are experts in upper limb stroke management, and they vetted this whole thing, and they argue about the minutest details, so we know it's going to be good if they could ever stop arguing, so we could. And we have a grant in, so hopefully soon this will be on your iPads. And then, you know, when when you're trying to sort through a patient that's very complex, has spasticity, poor sensation, some movement of the fingers, a painful shoulder, you'll be able to at least have, not a recipe, because I know people are opposed to recipes, but help you sort through the questions of how to do best practice management. So this is what it looks like. So pick the right tool screening or whatever. Pick them in all the domains that you think are important. That's what's driving me a little bit wacko right now. We seem to still be leaving out whole domains. There are impairments that we measure very, very thoroughly, and there are whole other areas important to outcome that we don't measure at all. And that's the end of the assessment one. Everybody take a quick stretch and play, and then we'll come back and do... If you have your notes from when you did the economics and you could pull them, do you remember at the first lecture? I asked you to take a quick look and see where we're spending our money and how much we're spending. And if not, don't worry about it, but if you have it, pull it up. Take a 15-minute, and then we'll come back and talk some more.
Thank you. Valérie Poulin.
It's my PhD student, Poulin. Yeah, if you look it up, her publication should be out. If not, I'll just PDF you.
Poulin.
What are you doing? Are you looking it up on Google?
I just couldn't remember her name, and I was just
going to look
it up.
Oh, you're
just typing it in? I'm just typing it in, so I don't forget.
I'll just send it all to you.
Yeah,
you too nice.
Yeah.
Just do it earlier in the week, because I'm flying out. So.
Okay. I'll do it now.
Yeah, then I'll have it. Yeah, I'll send them to you. Somebody just asked if, for one of the things I was talking to you about, the possibility. Sorry. It's okay. Go ahead. It's a long day for you, I know. Somebody was mentioning the possibility of looking at a module on spasticity and current treatment. Would that be interesting to you? Okay, so that's one of the ones that we'll add in. We'll fit it into the schedule. And get some of the people who are working specifically on some new ideas in spasticity management. I mean, one of the biggest, and I'm sure you've already heard about, is people used to believe, and that is no longer true, that if you had spasticity, you would not do strength training. And that has now been vetoed. So you can imagine that up until your training, people were, if they saw spasticity, not doing strengthening, with the belief that it would increase spasticity. And I think that's fun, again, to talk about, because it just shows you whatever you do as you go out there and start to practice, always question it, because we're learning all the time and we're changing practice for stroke all the time. All right, so one of the things we did, tell me a little bit about what you found in terms of, is stroke expensive when you went and looked it up? At the beginning, I know it's a couple of lectures ago. Was it an expensive? Dr. Wien told us $250 million. What was it when you looked it up? What does it cost the healthcare system in Canada, roughly? Anybody remember? $2.8 billion? Okay, so it depends on how you count it. If you count societal cost, days lost of work, the whole healthcare system. So let's just zoom in and only focus right now. And if you want to look at, if economics of stroke is of interest to you, and I'm sure most of you are, it's not, but if it is, Mike Sharma, Sharma, has been doing some nice work in costing out. So if you ever are interested, or if you ever need to argue, you're laughing now, but at one point you might direct a department or a unit, and you will need to argue out the cost of stroke versus what you're doing in rehab. And so it's nice to know some people who are publishing in the area. Okay, so let's not get so big that it has no meaning. And I think it's fun that you said, oh, I can't even remember. One of the problems is when something costs so much, it has no framework for you, and so it's overwhelming and you forget about the number. Let's talk, though, something more concrete. If I had $10, 10 single dollars in my hand, and I said to you, and I've done this at stroke conferences to make people understand where we spend our money. So if I had, and I usually bring Monopoly money, so 10 single dollars, And I said, okay, this is all the money that we have for a person who's had a stroke. We have 10 single dollar bills.
Okay.
Where do we spend that money? This is not hypothetical. This is, I'm telling you where we spend the money. But I'm sure you can start to figure it out.
A complex personality trait is nothing to compare with psychoanalysis. And
yet, I told you I'm not good at this stuff.
As you live your life, and as you come up with a
hello?
So I was trying to tell you.
I know. It's like an out-of-body experience for me up here. Ooh, maybe I... Okay, so let's go back, and if not, I'll throw the microphone away and whatever. Hello?
And I'm totally...
Yeah. Yeah, maybe we're both kind of overriding each other. I don't know. Let's try one last time. After that, I take off the mic. Okay, so we've got these 10 single dollar bills. What do we know about stroke quickly in terms of the context? Do people die in the first weeks? For the most part, no. We heard that the first lecture. How long and how many usually survive? And we're doing better and better. 70%, roughly? Is that what you learned? Okay. So we have 80% or so, let's say, are going to survive. We have people needing what? What do they need in terms of, is it a year? What's the average life expectancy? It's all part of the equation. About 7 years or so. We're going up and up. Some people are living 20, 30 years longer. Okay, so back to the question, where do we put, we have 10 single, I wonder if Lori Snyder is hearing me upstairs as she does pediatrics. Hi, Lori. Hello? So where do we put our 10 single dollars? In today's healthcare system, where are we putting it? Salaries? Okay. Salaries short-term, long-term? Both. Okay, anybody want to say anything? So the comment is we're using it on salaries, short and long-term. What kind of salaries? OTs, PTs, doctors? Okay, just to share with you that the OTPT part of this pie is... I have to take that last dollar and rip it in little pieces. Nursing care? Administration stuff. A lot of where we spend our dollars is in that very, very early period, right? So the person gets an MRI nowadays, a CT scan. We're talking about acute care hospitalization where there are nurses. But the structure of acute care is expensive because you have lab technologies. You know, if you're doing any of the TPA, the MRIs have to come in, the CT scans, etc. So you're giving most of those $10. It's like I always liken it to when you all got allowance. Did everybody get allowance as a kid? Yeah. Okay. So when you got your allowance, if you used it all on Saturday when you got it, the rest of the week didn't look too good. And so this is what we do in stroke care. Our upfront costs for that early period use up about 3/4 of everything we've got. And it would be nice to have your scenario, I like your scenario, where both you say, of course, logic says, well, we're going to save some for later because obviously the person needs something later. So the answer is no. There are very few resources for later. There are some stroke clubs or whatever, but there's very, very little out there. Has anybody worked in any units where they're bringing people in a year, 2 years post
for strengthening, bone density maintenance. It doesn't count. You're going to tell me Hong Kong. Okay. Tell us about Hong Kong. People were coming in late after stroke. Of coming back into the system. Okay. Okay. So, but, yeah. Okay, so that's a very interesting scenario. So one of the things we realize here, and one of the things that this new initiative for changing stroke care in Quebec says, is that people will have a right to come back into the system if their spasticity is worse, if they feel their lower limb is getting weaker, if they feel there's some return in the hand that wasn't there in the first weeks, and so now they feel ready. And so now what I wanted to talk to you about is, so we've kind of done a weird thing. We started as researchers doing a lot of research on chronic, what we call patients with chronic stroke, because they were easy. They were a captive audience. They were not changing because they were supposedly in this chronic state. And so they were easy to do research on. Oh, my goodness, we spited ourselves. We picked an easy group to do research on only to find out that interventions are effective in this group. So now we live, if we have a sense of morals and ethics, with this gap between having found out that no, everything that patients always told us, which is, I got better 3 and 4 years after. Oh my God, I was so ready at year one. That was when I really needed therapy and there was none. They always tell us that. And so now we have a gap between what we know is the evidence. And the, I found it great fun last year. There was actually a patient's family and the patient who sued for health services that they did not receive in the chronic phase of stroke because we now have evidence that there are things that work. So let's talk today. Now, you have to realize up until the 2010 best practice guidelines, and only the Canadian 2010 best practice guidelines, have separated out time since stroke. So up until now, we heard FES is effective for upper limb training post-stroke. Task-specific exercise is effective for upper limb or lower limb training post-stroke. But we had never separated out time since stroke and published it. We have now opened what they call a can of worms. We separated out the evidence. We wrote it on paper. We did all the research. We found out that there is this chronic phase that's not chronic, but people improve all the time. And now we have no resource system, process, or structure in place to treat the people that. So, very interesting. We've just written, that's what I was telling you, an international article from 4 countries where we pose the question of what are we going to do now in terms of getting these people treated. So what frustrates me a lot when I go to conferences, and I guess it's just pure, not really a jealous person per se, but probably a frustrated jealousy in some ways, is I sit through international conferences and national conferences on stroke, and the main focus is on those early, early hours post-stroke. And a lot of the monies go there. Like I said, at least 3/4 of the monies are going there. And a lot of the attention and excitement and pharmacology and the drug companies are putting their efforts there. But the reality is that's a very, very short window of time. And so this is the reality that we in rehab deal with, the goal of getting patients home. And so we know that if we're going to get patients home and back up those stairs, there's a multitude of things that have to happen. And that's where the monies dwindle. And certainly, there's a whole body of evidence you can look up on early supported discharge. Does it work? Are we doing it? Everybody prides themselves on shortened length of stays. But what are we sending home and in what shape?
So one of the things we need to do for a lot of the interesting work coming out is telling us that imagine what bone density, all of you exercise in some way or another, do something, so because you sit so much, like on Tuesdays, it's horrendous. So imagine bone density if Tuesdays was repeated 7 days a week for you. Horrid. Horrid? Just a horrid thought, right? Tuesdays is not a good day in terms of sitting. And so we take a clientele and we discharge them home, and they're spending most of their days like you spend Tuesday, sitting. And then we have done a very good job, and they survive longer than they used to because we treat the acute care issues and we manage their diabetes even in terms of, you know, changing physical levels of functioning, etc. But we don't do anything else. And that's been the scenario for the last 20 years. So now we start to measure things like bone density. What do you think the bone density looks like on an affected hemiplegic lower limb? Venture a guess. Horrible, right? Yep. First of all, you're barely weight-bearing. What do you need to do to have good bone density? You've all learned it in weight-bearing. So here we are barely weight-bearing through a lower limb, potentially. And on top of that, we're doing much less in terms of. And so there have been beautiful studies recently by Janice Eng out in UBC, a physio who's shown that if you get people in chronic stroke out and doing activities, pushing them hard, you will improve bone density. You can actually turn around their bone density. So again, yeah, go ahead. Pushing them hard, good question. So I always parallel this to our original, you know, with myocardial infarct, where we used to be so worried and people would go home after a heart attack and sit for a month and then go back to work. So obviously you have to know what you're doing, and you have to measure pulse rates and heart rates, and there has to be approval and close team supervision. But we'll talk about it. We'll take a look. And so she's been pushing them hard. She's a tough cookie from Hong Kong, actually. And she pushes hard. She really probably in the last 8 years or so has done the toughest push. She's also created that GRASS program that was referred to, the GRASS program. She does all kinds. She does pool programs, but this one, and she does gym circuit training. A lot of the things when Janice started them were things we had done many, many years ago that were considered not popular during the NDT movement, because you were only supposed to look that patient in the eye and do one-on-one, and anything else you did as a therapist was useless. You pass that off to the OT or PT aide or to the recreational therapist. But she does a lot of, you know, kind of old-fashioned slash modern combo. So it's circuit training, very...
I heard her speak once that she said, like, it was you and I were saying, putting money into all that acute stuff, and, like, people don't find it, like, she said, like it's not sexy to work it with the chronic patients. So
that's right. It's all about sexy, right? Because if you're going to get a beautiful big conference venue and a nice meal on the table, it used to be the pharma that did that. So you'd sit through and have the most elegant four-course meal and have to listen to Botox 101 over and over so you'd have lunch. You know? And yes, we don't have it. But, you know, the irony is we're doing a lot of sexy stuff now on virtual reality, robotics. I'm going to show you some of the stuff. There's still the room for the, you know, something more basic if you don't have the machines. So we'll talk about that. So I don't know if any of you know who Pamela Duncan is. Certainly if you've read the literature, Pamela Duncan is a physio who I'm really proud of. I mean, she's been a leader and has cut through all of the, you know, she's just made her way to the top. So she wrote the best practice guidelines for the United States. She's come out with some major trials. And she's just ashamed, really ashamed, and that's why I've put this up, of this slide. So Pam and I did, 2 years ago at the Canadian Stroke Congress, we did myths of stroke rehab. And so we went back and forth. And And so she says, she puts this up, and this was her big study in 1992, and she showed how, you know, after a certain amount of days, patients flatline, and they don't improve after that. And all of this was great, so we could all justify sending our patients home. Remember that when we started doing research, before that we were clinicians looking at a 30 Royal Vic 30-day stay in acute care and a 70-day stay in rehab for a moderate stroke. Yeah. So we had 100 days. They were delicious, wonderful days. They really were. They were fabulous days. Because in acute care, you could feel like you interacted, you assessed, you treated, you moved them over to rehab, and in rehab, you were able to see huge progress, and really, if if the patient wanted to be there, you could go on home visits, and you could make sure they were self-medicating and cooking and doing all of the basic stuff calmly before they were discharged. And so we always felt really good because after 100 days, 100 days is roughly how many months? 3 months. So they had plateaued anyways, was what we were trained and believed. So you were sending them home at their maximal best plateau. So it was a much less guilt-ridden world to work in terms of stroke rehab. Now I meet with lots and lots of clinicians. I was just in Thunder Bay, as you know, trying to persuade them it's just as good as Hawaii. And that's what they're living with. They're living with the guilt of trying to get it right in a very short time, sending people to very rural areas, and feeling like they didn't manage to do all that they could have right for the patient. And so Pam shows this nowadays, not to show the results of her study and the whatever, but to show that this is now wrong. And this is old evidence. So when someone says to you, 3 months is the window of recovery, don't let them feel comfy in that zone. And here's all the evidence we have. We have tons of it. So those are all the things we need if we're going to have a stroke and continue to live on. People with a stroke have a right to have cardiac health. They have a right to all the other things that we expect as we age. And so when we tell them this, it's not true. And so these are, I've gone through and I've looked at all of these different therapies to get a good idea. And we'll talk about all of them. So these therapies are all used in subacute stroke as well. I just wanted today to really give the punch that our patients are patients for longer and they are not treated. And have any of you had CLSC rotations? In Ontario? Did you do any people who were longer post-stroke, or you did acute community reintegration? Okay. So let's look. So if you're going to argue for something like this, and you will be the champions of this, because things have to change. They can't stay the same. So you will have to be the champions for treatment of this group, and be it in our home care systems or community-based programs or circuit training, private practice, whatever you have to set up to make it happen. So what I always say is, here's this lady, and you see this very foggy picture, and here's her question. I had a stroke last year. My hand and leg are partially paralyzed. And are there any effective therapies for me? How many people are able to answer that today definitively for this person if they were to ask you that? So let's go through the literature. Let's see. It's very recent literature. And let's see if by the end of today we have some directions for treating this group. So mirror therapy, everyone know what it is? the good old, you didn't you have a session last week on mirror therapy? A group of you did, I think. Oh, no, it wasn't here. It was somewhere else that they were having a full session. Have any of you used it? The person behind you, and then tell us about it. So tell us what happened. Upper limb?
Both the upper and lower limb. And we were working, she was an outpatient, so this was an acute care, but she was seeing my supervisor for outpatient still. And we were using the mirror actually to train her center of gravity too. She was really to the left side of the left. She was leaning more to the left and then her center of gravity was there. So we would use the mirror to help her.
So the mirror was this kind of mirror? Okay, so it wasn't a mirror box.
It was a mirror box, sorry.
And did you use mirror box?
Oh, still in Hong Kong.
We have to do our next placements in Hong Kong. Wow.
And it was both at home and...
And was it upper limb and lower limb?
Upper limb.
So how many people have actually used it? But you all understand the philosophy behind it and how to do it. Now, the nice thing about it is if it works, if the whole idea is that you kind of trick your brain, right? So that when you're moving... So let's say we have a left-hand paralysis. We put it on this side. We've got a little mirror box. And we're moving our right hand. Okay, so everyone sees this one's our paralyzed side. We're moving this. The mirror's here. What are we seeing when we look at, when we tell the patient, look in the mirror, what are they seeing in the mirror? They're not seeing this, right, because this is hidden. They're seeing what looks like a moving left hand, because it's a mirror image. Now, when that first came out, it was like, is this gimmicky? Is this silly? And it came out in the Gazette, on the front page of the Gazette. And so, of course, at the time I was working at the Jewish Rehab, and the patients cut it out and said, look, this works. Why aren't we getting it here at the Jewish Rehab? It's like, scramble, scramble. Let's go find out if this works. And at that point, we didn't know if it worked. There was no evidence, but it was interesting. And so what do we know now about it? If it works, what should our brain do? If I can really trick my brain, because it's not my hand I'm tricking, right? Is it my hand I'm tricking? It's my brain that I'm tricking. So if this is paralyzed, but I'm not seeing it, but when I look in the mirror, oh, look at my left hand, it's moving beautifully, right? Now I'm okay. What should be happening up here? I should be seeing some firing in the motor cortex up here. If my motor cortex thinks that things are happening, and what would you use for that? Functional MRIs. Yeah. So the evidence came out. So people were starting it. It was like a gimmick. Look, look, look. What a good idea. And then what they found was they did the studies, and sure enough, there was firing in the motor cortex. So we can trick the brain to think that that hand is moving. So that was some evidence that maybe mirrors, other than just doing a small little study of two patients or whatever and saying, well, that's great, might be worth taking to the next level. And of course, like I said, usually your captive audience for these types of things are people who aren't changing anymore. And so, you know, they have some upper limb, but very little. But they still want to be pushing and doing, and they're motivated to try something. And so mirror therapy and chronic stroke has been found to be effective for grip strength, wrist function, and speed of movement. And often on the Stroke Engine family site, because I have a button that says contact us, people will write me and say, what should I be doing? My arm looks like this. And I don't really like giving advice over email, but I'm pretty comfortable if they have some movement in saying, take a box, put a mirror, and if it's something you want to do, try that and see how you feel about it. So it's one of the things that you can actually suggest when a patient says, well, what am I supposed to do? Will you, I won't have you when I go home. This is one of the things that I find is worthwhile sharing with them to do. Does it work for the lower limb? Yeah. It's the movements that you want. It's a good question. So the question is, can you do any movements? Can you make this up as you go? I mean, obviously, you can read protocols, and as you said, how often you do it and how intense. But it's the movements that you can, you know, that you choose. You can start doing hand picking up a cup if you feel. So you would judge, again, as a therapist, what they're able to do clinically, and you would give it a try. But everyone should give it a try when they're in clinic because it's cheap. You're able to do it, right? And what was the reaction of the patients? That's what I need to know. Did they think you were weird? Did they think it was interesting? Did it mix them up? So I guess that's a really good point again, and that's why this is never going to be packaged programming. It's always interactive with a clinician who knows and picks up the cues and knows which patient can match in terms of cognitive, in terms of concentration, understanding something that's a little more abstract in terms of training. Well, you know, it's nice that you're asking the question, did you see results over 5 weeks? Because what we know now unequivocally in terms of stroke rehab is intensity, intensity, intensity. In the subacute phase, intensity of treatment makes all the difference to outcome. And we also know that we do not have a system in place in terms of rehab to give the intensity that's best practice. So if you have a person that's keen, if you have a family member that could do it with them, if you, you know, show them on an iPad or whatever, here are the three things you're going to do, that's a way of increasing intensity. Because it's exhausting to move a limb that's not moving well. And so this is another way of giving intensity without the physical effort. It's a lot of cognitive effort. And so, again, we need to know more, but we do know that in subacute it's effective. So our brain is starting to say lower limb is probably effective too. Aerobic, does it work? So again, you were asking me intensity or whatever. The thing is you need lots. A lot of the early studies didn't do, like this one is 24 sessions. This is the dance class that Pat McKinley does, so she gave me permission to take the pictures. One of the fun things is that if you look at this is pushing and shoving. When you're doing balance training with patients, have any of you done balance training with patients? Okay. Tell me a little bit about what you did. Have them stand on foam? Oh, just okay. Orthopedic, stand and foam, close their eyes, narrow base of support. Okay, all right. Anybody else? Have you tried with stroke? Okay, so you would put them off balance? Yeah. No, but you would put them off balance. So, like that?
Okay. Okay. Which games?
Pardon?
Which games? You fail at that one, too?
Yeah.
You can grade them, yeah. Okay. So far-reaching and changing position while in activity, or you can use the DynaVision with the lighting crossing the midline is good for attention at the same time, whatever. One of the fun things that people have been using now that works really well is... The dance is great, yeah, but we're talking about a lower-level patient now, but yes, for higher-level balance, is instead of... Because I was always trained to do that, right? And then it's a lot more fun if you say, push me. So stand up for a sec, if you don't mind, and come over here. Okay. I have heels on, so I'll just take them off for a minute. Okay. So typically what we've always been trained to do is kind of, okay, Mrs. So-and-so, look, you're, I see a big improvement from last week, right? This is what we do, right? So much more fun for them. Okay, now you push me. And you say, okay, try to push me and watch what you'll have to do. Okay, so now I'm back here. So it's like, okay, try to push me again. She's a stubborn mule. She won't. Eventually she's going to have to step forward and she's going to have to move her center of gravity. But the fear is totally different, right? It's one thing to be the pusher and one thing to be pushed. And so... Now I don't do them anymore. Like I don't, because there's a stress and whatever, but you'll see that the patients will giggle or like kind of smirk, especially a big guy's trying to push you over. You're getting the exact same outcome, but it's a lot nicer as an interaction in terms of, okay. So one of the things we know now is that a lot of the early studies didn't do enough intensity. So if you're looking at the aerobics, we need, we will improve in this clientele everything, bone density, VO2 max. So both, like, the only things, if you look up on Stroke Engine, depending on which study, sometimes fatigue won't change or walking distance per se won't change. So sometimes the functional outcomes are less likely to change. So you have to take a look. But overall, aerobic, and again, obviously, the same conditions apply as to a cardiac patient. You have to make sure that they're approved for it. But this fear that they'll stroke again or have a heart attack has taken us away from giving proper treatment. So we have to come back the other way at this point. And this is best done in circuit training, I think, is what we're starting to see. So we do know now that there's strong conclusion that it works. Increases VO2 max, like I said, and you'll see versus other types of therapies. Now, what about FES use in chronic stroke? So a home FES machine is very inexpensive. You know more about FES machines than I do. How much are the new ones? They're like $100 and some odd. So really another good choice for somebody who's going home and who you feel could have potential, who's cognitively aware, and similarly for lower limb training. And again, we have seen that it works late after stroke to continue to improve patient outcomes. And so you'll see. So again, these are things that we don't use. Do you know the intensity of use of FES in Canada for people who are subacute? Very poor, very low. Very, very low in clinic. And we used to blame it on the expense of the machine. We used to blame it on people don't know how to. And I think we're just getting to the point where we can't use excuses anymore. We just have to know how and use them. And again, we've seen that it works on walking speed, coordination, et cetera, et cetera.
What about constraint-induced therapy? Have you all heard about it? Okay. So let's face it. This is Dr. Stephen Wolf. Have you all heard of Dr. Steve Wolf? People see the picture and go, Steve, you had a lot more hair when the call took that one. It's not nice. I couldn't believe someone said that at the last Congress. Stephen Wolf did the largest study ever. He's the mastermind behind the multi-site study across the U.S. that came out that constraint-induced therapy works. But when you look at how many clinicians are actually using it, very few. And it's a very intense program. And now most people are trying modified constraint-induced because constraint-induced is just not possible. The patients fry out. The clinicians can't cope with the thought that they're not doing it right. And so modified is starting to look very, very good. And especially if you think of a patient who's gone home, and we all know that when a patient leaves the stroke unit, they're disappointed for the most part because they're likely not perfect, and you haven't kept them to perfect. And so they're going home disappointed, thinking of all the things they didn't. And so what I find would be great now is if we have these, and if our new Quebec system gets put in place, these comeback loops. So you say to them, in 2 months from now, when you're feeling stronger and you see more signs of your arm working, come back on in, because then we'll work on these types of things. And at that point, you could just focus on upper limb, modify constraint-induced, and just spend 6 to 8 weeks intensely doing that. And you probably have a more engaged patient, and it is successful. And so, again, it's a matter... Does everyone know how it works? There's whole pamphlets on it. You can read exactly how to do it. Task-oriented training. The other day, last week, we talked about sit to stand. What a simple, simple, simple thought. Sue Baraka is a clinician who likes to dabble in research in Ontario. And she kept seeing patients after stroke who just couldn't get out of a chair. They just couldn't get up. And if you can't get up out of a chair, you can't go anywhere. You can't do anything. It's a very basic premise. So Sue Baraka decided, what are you watching? Okay. She's been laughing for the last 20 minutes. I want to know what you're laughing about. So Sue Baraka decided she would do this very simple trial, very, very simplistic, where she would just get everybody on the team to get patients from sit to stand over and over and over again all day long. Obviously not all day long, but the premise was if you do something over and over and over, you're going to succeed. And her study showed huge differences between the group who were trained that way. And it became a very basic premise of sit to stand, sit to stand, sit to stand. And that's where a lot of this, we went back, based on a lot of Sue Baraka's work, a clinician every day in there trying to get these patients up and about, that we need to return to repeated efforts at task-specific exercise. And the more you do, the more it works. And for those of you who are interested in athletics and Olympic champions, etc., what we know is practice, practice, practice. And not just physical practice, but these people do a lot of mental practice. And those who really succeed do a lot of training with coaches who also know about mental imagery. And so that was the next thing that came out, and we're going to look at what's the evidence for mental imagery in people with chronic stroke or in people with a subacute stroke. So we have strong evidence, again, that task-oriented training works. It's a basic philosophy. Repetitive training does not work as well. So if you have no task and you just make people do things over and over, it is not helpful. You need to throw in a task. And I think that makes sense to all of us, right? Making me do something over and over that has absolutely no meaning, like washing my floors, which I did this morning before I came. So it improves all of these things, all right? So again, very basic, but I'm showing you all this I'm showing you all this evidence, but 10 years ago, none of it was there. So it comes to be like, oh, another slide of everything that works. Oh, another slide of everything that works. Oh, my goodness, that works too. But remember, today's lecture is about the fact that in the last 6 years or so, all of these trials, each one hundreds of thousands of dollars to run, has come out showing effectiveness on key outcomes, not nonsense outcomes, for people with chronic stroke. And yet we have a healthcare system in Canada, in Quebec, that has no opportunity within our public healthcare system to treat any of these people. So that's why the push is right now to create a new system where maybe, as you say, as in Hong Kong and in Australia, they're pushing for the same, that you come back in. Video gaming, as you said, is great fun. The nice thing about video gaming also is that there's something natural and normal to it. You can play with other people. It's not a therapy as much. However, you have to be careful. You pointed out that, you know, it's hard to do, and if you don't gauge it, and I mean, I've got a husband that, I'll bring you the videos of my husband, it's funny. My son-in-law, after a couple of drinks, which he purposely pours down my non-drinking husband, will set up like the hula hoop, okay? Or what else is there? Tennis. There's a tennis one? Okay. So, you know, here, the trouble with the tennis, what's the problem? I mean, you've all been trained in activity analysis and proprioceptors and whatever. What are you whacking against? You're whacking against nothing. You're playing tennis. You know, well, my husband and son-in-law are equally male alpha male, you know? And so they're competing there, and I'm thinking to myself, okay, rapid speed dial to his physio for tomorrow morning, because he's just like, whoops. And he's going, and he's, don't worry about it, it's not an expensive one. And he's, it's not real, those diamonds aren't real, if you figure that one out. And he's just whacking away, and they're whacking, and then the hula hoop is like, you know. And then he goes home with, like, I don't know what happened to me yesterday. And so I think to myself, here we are, you know, sitting in congresses. It's okay, sweetie. We're sitting in congresses and we're thinking. Now I feel bad. You picked up my beads for me. Thank you. We're sitting in congresses thinking, like, oh, yes, you know, let's use the Wii and let's whatever. And I'm thinking, oh, no, like, it does major damage to my family members. Like, so I think, again, that's the point of, let's use virtual reality. Let's use the Wii. Let's have fun. Let's do things that can incorporate at home easily. That's something that, you know, for holiday time, the family can buy the Wii. But let's not do it without the therapeutic piece to it, because it's not safe. If, I mean, balance when you get overly, or the hula hoop thingy. So, again, I only see it as beneficial if you've really got good common sense going on behind it. If not, I wouldn't use it. And again, I love this lady. She's having so much fun at it. We don't have great upper extremity evidence yet, but this is, again, coming. It's coming rapidly. A lot of people are doing the trials right now, and we'll know very soon a lot more about what's working. And motor imagery. So I don't have a perfect picture of it, so this is not great. But again, the idea that you have a limb that's weak. Let's put ourselves for a minute, because we talk in these abstract terms. Put yourself into the role of somebody who's just had a stroke. You spent 4 days or 5 or 6 days in hospital. You weren't terrible. You had no medical crises, and now they've switched you over to one of our hospitals here in our network, the Jewish Rehab or whatever. And now you're expected the next day, you were kind of in this blue Johnny shirt, and now you're expected to get dressed, and they say things to you like, do you have shorts? Do you have a pair of sneakers? And you're thinking, I haven't worn shorts in the last, you know. And so the family starts to bring you in these shorts that are, you know, riding up the whatever, and you're supposed to now go down to therapy and look like an athlete or something, and sneakers that... And so there's this whole new role for you, right? You're 82 years old. Like, you weren't planning these shorts and sneaker things, but, hey, that's what they asked for, and the family brought in all sizes, varieties, and whatever. And now there's, like, all these things that you're expected to do. Yes? Lots of things. You get on the mat, you get off the mat, you go down to OT, you go to speech language, you go over to the psychologist, they ask you a bunch of questions, then you go back, you take a little nap, you eat weird food. If you're on a dysphagic diet, they don't let you eat any food that you actually like. Your best friend brings in your favorite cake, they grab it away from you yelling, "Don't touch that!" You know? And that's how your day's progressing your first day, right? And that's what happens. And then there's us, the rehab team. And we're saying things like, you want to try mirrors? You want to try a video game? It's like overwhelming. So again, these are all the different things we can use, obviously, with the right person at the right time. But if you think of motor imagery, and you think of this patient and how tired they are now, okay? But let's say this patient's highly motivated. So they're tired, and it's weird, and their clothes aren't their own clothes, and their bed's not their own bed, and it has that plastic thing that when you sleep, you sweat and stick to the pillow, and it's really uncomfortable. So nothing's quite right, and nothing feels good, and they put the bars up at night, and you can't get down, and you know that you don't have a long time to get to pee because, you know, you're old now, and you got to get there in a hurry, and now they tell you find the bell, and don't go by yourself, it's not safe. And then you have mental imagery. Well, mental imagery is great for the very motivated patient who goes, oh my God, I'm exhausted from all that, you know, he or she put me through today. But they told me that the brain, and I think you said it beautifully in Hong Kong, that you had patients that were with you. You could explain it in a simple manner, but they were with you on it. It's like, hey, ooh, that sounds like, yeah, I could do that, okay? So that was mirror, but it's the same idea. If you explain to someone that athletes, you know, Mr. So-and-so, athletes use this. Would you like to try it? The idea is that you're too tired. You can't spend the whole day moving that arm. It's hard work, and I understand that. But would you like to sometimes, when you're having a rest and you've had your rest and there's no activity going on, practice opening and closing your fingers with the thought that your brain is practicing that as well. Now, what we know, and we'll talk about it more, is that Francine Malouin up at University of Quebec has created a scale now, and it's M-A-L-O-U-I-N, and she's created a scale to look at someone's capacity to do mental imagery, because we know not all patients are going to be able to succeed. And so she's created a nice scale where you can actually assess if this person is going to be able to use mental imagery. And if they are, if they're motivated, if they're doing task-specific training, if they have some mirror therapy that they're doing with a family member, I guarantee you, using all those level one evidences combined will result in better arm function than the person who's not using that combo. So the idea then is not to have somebody without expertise saying mental imagery, oh, does it work? I have no idea what it is, but let's give it. But is to have expert OTs and PTs like you working together, informing each other that, you know, I notice this person has high-level executive functioning. They're able to rationalize. They understand. They comprehend when I explain to them what intensity means. You know, this person was a business person. They were working well before the stroke. And so that's, to me, the specialty of stroke rehab. That's what the chart, like I told you, I've always loved working with this clientele because when you become good at it, and you take that one person who's unique and you match up everything you know, and we have such a rich pool of evidence now, then you really feel like you got it right. And that getting it right matches the personality of the person, all of those stroke sequelae that we talked about that you assess for, combining it all together with motivation, interest, task-specific matching to who the person is, and that's a real treatment plan. That's what real intervention is. I'm really impressed to hear that you went to a different country, you had a stage, you decided they didn't use a certain treatment. I'm impressed with them for saying, give it a try, right? And that you followed through on it. I'm really impressed. And so this is old news. there are some brand new studies out, again, looking at motor imagery. The reason, though, now we think that the level of evidence wasn't strong and there was some inconsistent findings is those early studies, which early, like 3 years ago, did not look for a person's ability to mental image before they randomized them. So there's no sense giving somebody who can't ride a bike and say, geez, didn't use the bike this week. Okay? So that's what I'm finding fun, is that as we get more sophisticated, it's individualized medicine. And we hear individualized medicine in cancer treatment, in all treatments. And then when the dean says here at McGill, Dean of Medicine, so are you guys in rehab doing anything about individualized patient management? We sure are in stroke. We really need to get there. And that's what I hope you'll leave this course with, is I don't need to stand up here and tell you levels of evidence for stuff because it's going to change next year. I mean, what works will likely continue to work, but some of the things that don't work is because we're not selecting out the patients properly and picking the right match. And then there's the, you know, virtual reality. There's some nice evidence. Mindy Levin, who will be lecturing next week, did a systematic review with one of the researchers. And we had done one previously with somebody by the name of Henderson had done it. And so we have nice evidence starting that it works. And so I guess what I just wanted to say to you is, so when a lady says to you this question that was posed, I had a stroke last year. My hand and leg are partially paralyzed. Are there effective therapies for me? Will you be able to unequivocally answer this lady's question? And you will get calls. You will get calls. I get them all the time. So-and-so's friend's mother had a stroke and wants to know. And so now you feel confident, I hope, saying that there's no such thing as chronic. You can continue to improve, and the evidence is strong. And that's a message that we need to get out. We need to get it out. And we need to get it out to families, because I think the best way to advocate is, you know, through you guys out there and through our families. And that's why now, if you notice, we have a restructuring of the Stroke Engine site, the family site, with a button that says Living with Stroke. And we did that for those people who didn't just come out of acute care, didn't just have the stroke yesterday, didn't just come out of subacute, but they're living with it, so that they will become aware that they have rights to quality care. Can you imagine any other disease where you find that people can improve with a new drug for diabetes, with, you know, and we don't give it to anybody? To nobody? Anybody. Nobody gets it. We found it works over and over and over again. This drug works, but we're not giving it to anybody. This is what we do in chronic stroke. We found over and over, we spent millions and millions and millions of dollars. We did our rehab. We did it right. We did randomized trials, high-level evidence, and we give it to nobody. It's a system that's got to change. So we're hoping that we're going to really make lots of noise through families and to teach you that it's not okay, to tell people that that's it. And to just keep pushing with all different, and this is my favorite. So we have, currently we have 300,000 people here in Canada who are living with stroke. And my favorite buddy is Mr. Ron. Have you met Mr. Ron? Have you ever seen my talks with Mr. Ron? There's Mr. Ron. And every year on his birthday, we take a picture together. I started treating Mr. Ron when he was 86. Severely, severely handicapped up at the Montreal General. Had everything going for him badly. Diabetic, which increased your risk, remember Dr. Weens? Nothing good, you know, previous bladder cancer, diabetic, massive stroke, massive, massive stroke. 10 years later, and he just hit his 97th, and he's busy working. He is fortunate that he has money, so he has a chauffeur that takes him to work. And he has a very, very, I took the picture out because I didn't know for, because we're posting this lecture. But he runs a company that has a very, very racy line of men's underwear. And so Mr. Ron is my hero. And every time I take Mr. Ron with me somewhere, because I take him with me everywhere, I send him a quick email and I tell him, Mr. Ron, you just went to Australia with me. And he goes, oh, really? And Mr. Ron, you just went to Glasgow with me. He goes, really? And next week, Mr. Ron will be in Dublin with me, and I will not be here. Mindy Levin will be here. I will tell her that you want to hear specifics on clinical practice for upper limb. She's going to work with you. Have you already had lectures from Dr. Levin? The physio has. And so I really have given her firm directions to focus on clinical for hopefully all of you, both disciplines. I'll be in Dublin at their national congress. I'll be opening at their congress next week and meeting with the clinicians there, and then I'll be back the following week. So, again, no assignment for this week. I thought you could use a rest. I know that the term gets crazier and crazier as we go in. For those of you who feel that you're ready to send me the first assignment, do that in the next bit. And the second assignment that we will have, I will separate out based on your interests. So we'll talk about that in a week's time when I get back, okay? And it'll be customized to what you're interested in. Anything? I think you've sat long enough today. Isn't Mr. Ron cute? He's a devil, though.
Thank you.
They don't have a structure, but they're taking it away from St. Mary's because they're not best practice evidence. That's what Ted was saying, though. Ted Wien was saying, because he works there too, he was saying, but it's a good place. It's a good place, but their standards of care for stroke don't match best practice. Oh, I don't know. I'm not saying which discipline. I'm saying overall they've been judged they will not be one of the places that have stroke overall. And they're very upset about it. They're very upset about it, that they will not get stroke. They're not doing what is needed for stroke management.
You told us to focus on, like, if you're working on balance, to focus on balance. So any assessment we should consider should be, like, balance-oriented, kind of.
Right? Well, you can have balance in walking. You can have balance, like, you decide. I'm not rigid about things. Like, I don't want to box you. I hate assignments where it's like, and if you don't do that, you lose 3 points. Do what you think. Like, use common sense what you would do clinically.
Because I was just discussing with my friend, like, maybe, like, we should assess neglect, like, if he has, like,
you can put, I see what you mean, because it's only one page and because it's a specific assignment, you can put in one sentence that says, we would need to rule out this, this, and this prior to initiating that. Yeah, that shows you're thinking of the whole patient.
Okay.
Yeah. But I don't want you to spend like half of a page on neglect, because we'll have an assignment that maybe you could do.
Okay.
All right.
Hi. First, I wanted to apologize. My brother just found out he got a teacher's college, so he was sending
me
back. He found out he got a teacher's college, so he was texting.
Oh, wonderful.
So
you just looked like you were so happy about something.
No,
like, something was clear.
I apologize.
Yeah.
Like,
no,
don't
be
really
silly.
I have a question for you. So you were talking about swallowing between speech paths and OTs.
Yeah.
So I'm from Ontario, so I know that in Quebec there's a distinction, but in Ontario it seems like it's very gray because it depends on where you go. Because I did one of my placements in Ontario in a private clinic, and we had someone come in like for ortho issues, but the patient was post stroke, and they had a private an OT that kind of comes on like a case by case basis, and the clinic actually gave the swallowing portion to the OT, so it's supposed to be SLP.
Well, I kind of fought hard. Mm-hmm. And you can see that the 2010 best practices.
Yeah.
Because it changed from the word SLP.
Yeah.
Because I think it's the wrong way to get best practices.
Mm-hmm.
So Ontario now has the same best practice and they always try to follow. So it's said by a trained whatever.
Okay.
So now Rosemary Martino at U of T did the TORBEST, which is the recommended swallowing assessment. So she's trying to say that every single person has to do her tool.
Right.
Now I work with Rosemary, so I'm not trying to make
work
together. But it's a political slash whatever thing, but I always look at the patient. The reality is the patient needs somebody on the team who's going to do it right and going to do it when they're there.
Right.
Early.
Okay. And in your experience, like,
here it's OT.
Yeah. And
back is OT.
And ironically, like, I've worked with, you know, in my placements, like, I have yet to have a neuro placement, so I haven't really done, you know.
Yeah.
Like,
so if you go up to the MUHC, you'll be on a placement.
Yeah.
And when they...
And you're, like, the swallowing person for whoever comes in.
My daughter worked there, Tatiana, and Petzl, they're all...
And, like, just based on your experience, do you find that OTs are probably more comprehensive in looking at stroke compared to speech? Like, do you have that distinction? Because...
For dysphagia?
Yeah, for swallowing.
I would never compare the two disciplines.
Yeah.
I think across the country, clearly, it's been speech protecting domain.
It's so interesting, because I find that OT works so much better on it. I don't know if it's because speech is very focused on, like, you know, the neurology behind both speech, language, and any organs associated with that. But I find that the training that, you know, PTs and OTs get in global picture provides are the better treatment for swallowing.
Look who we are having this conversation.
I know, it's ironic because
with more people, like if we had a
I know, it's
language,
totally loaded. It's totally
it's
loaded.
It's funny you're saying about your brother because yesterday my son's girlfriend got into SLP.
Oh, wow.
And she was just like, we've been waiting, and she was just shrieking on the
yeah.
phone, so excited. And I was like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. So
yeah.
Those are good moments.
It is. It's exciting. So I wanted to just clarify that because I was a little confused about the domains, because coming from Ontario, it's different. You know, when you're from, like, as, you know, Laura was mentioning, between the CLSC or the CCAC, the services you get are very
yeah.
different. So,
but also, like, within the home base, because I know quite a few of my daughter's friends, like, in Ottawa, work in the home base sector.
Mm-hmm.
They're OTs, and they go home to home to home to
mm-hmm.
home. And I think there's, like you say, there's more need in the home for somebody who can understand function
exactly.
and dangers and home safety and all
yeah.
the, so it's a logic that they can also catch at the stage at.
Exactly.
Versus you wouldn't have like an SLP going into a home.
And doing
somebody.
Like a safety assessment.
No.
So in the training of OTs then.
But that's not where you should be picking up a poster
well,
stage.
That's
right?
also true. Yeah.
So, I mean, nobody's monitoring
mm-hmm.
because it does sometimes.
See, to me, that even becomes like an ethical issue then. Like, are we looking at things the right way to pick up these things? Like, to pick up someone who's, you know, maybe was missed? Because in just in terms of, like, when you're looking at swallowing, it has to do with nutrition, too. So that ropes in, you know, another aspect. Like, well, what if they're at the respect? Exactly. Aspiration, pneumonia, and all of that stuff. So it's interesting.
See, to me, that's why I like stroking.
But is there someone out there you have to go and invite them in?